we have been saying, Uranium One, this will be one of the biggest scandals in American history involving a foreign country.
The coordinated effort this week to resurface the long-debunked Uranium One conspiracy.
The Clinton Foundation failed to disclose major contributions from entities involved in this Uranium One deal.
Now we're seeing the Uranium One hoax from the book resurface in White House press briefings.
I mean, what is it going to take to put this woman in jail?
Dueling narratives on Fox News and MSNBC regarding the Uranium One deal. We'll learn more about what that even is and why it's in the news again later in the show. First, though, the Republican tax plan is moving through Congress. A vote is expected tomorrow in the House. California could be especially hard hit by that plan, which would affect the housing market, tech employees, and the many Californians who take state and local tax deductions. While critics say this is not a coincidence, it's part of a larger Republican strategy to target the Golden State, they say, the self-anointed center of the Trump resistance. But Central Valley Congressman and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy is sticking by the plan. He says it would help California taxpayers. Well, here to help us untangle these political weeds is Adam Nagorny, LA Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Great to have you. Well, okay, let's start with some of the measures in the tax bill that would hurt Californians. How significant are they and how deep would the cuts be?
I mean, if you own a house or if you pay pay state and local taxes, they can be pretty significant. State officials estimate that over 6 million California taxpayers take a deduction for state and local taxes. That's one of every three taxpayers. In addition, there's a mortgage deduction, and I think it's like 4 million California taxpayers take the mortgage deduction. So, you know, it can be very, very significant. I mean, property taxes, state taxes here are really high, as you probably know, and housing prices here are really high, and it's not unusual to have, you know, a pretty big mortgage. I think the last thing I saw is the House bill capped the mortgage deduction at $500,000, which seems like a lot, but in parts of California, people have mortgages that are bigger than that. So I think it's going to hurt California, and I think it's going to hurt New York, and I think it's generally going to hurt, by design or not, blue states more than any other state.
Well, definitely the average housing price here in LA is higher than $500,000, so it would hit a lot of people.
Right. And I think, like, to be clear, the more I'm talking about, I was talking about it too. We're talking about the mortgage. So, like, if you were to buy a $5 million house, I'm sure neither of us ever would, and you took a $500,000 mortgage, that would be covered. But most people who buy a $5 million house have a much bigger mortgage, obviously.
And then there are also these other parts of the bill that are smaller but also could be significant. People who maybe lose their homes or part of their homes in a wildfire couldn't deduct that loss.
Yeah, the House bill, I don't know whether it's in the Senate bill now, it's a moving target. The House bill included these provisions that eliminated the ability to take personal deductions for losses in a wildfire or an earthquake, which, you know that kind of sometimes happens here in California, and not for hurricanes or tornadoes. So
that's interesting.
That's why there's some people who think that maybe to some extent it's directed here. But
okay, so what about that? Do you think there's anything to that?
I think that I don't want to impute motives on anything, but what I would say is that there is less of an impetus on the part of Republicans who control the White House, who control the House, who control the Senate, to look out for Californians. In other words, like, is that, you know, who knows if they're trying to maliciously go after people? I mean, you know, far be it from me to speculate. But there's not that much of an incentive to say, hey, my voters are getting hurt. Let me protect them. So, you know, it's sort of quite, so I think that's what's going on here.
Well, so maybe a sin of omission rather than commission in this particular case. But we do have some powerful Republicans here in California, Kevin McCarthy, House Majority Leader, right? I mean, why would he sign on to this if it would hurt his constituents?
So I think that's one of the most interesting stories going on this year, at least from a perspective of California. He, you know, we've written about this a few times. He's kind of torn in two ways, right? On one hand, Trump has called him his closest ally on the Hill. He's loyal to the House. He's loyal to the president. This is a big deal for the House to get this bill. They haven't gotten anything done this year. There are a lot of Republicans who think they can't hold on to the House unless they get this or something done. So he's got a lot of pressure to do that. On the other hand, you know, I think, and I'll give you his explanation in a second, you know, we do think this is going to hurt a lot of Californians. And beyond that, he's got at least seven members, Republican members, most of them in Orange County, who are in really competitive races. And you better believe that this is an issue that they're going to use against them. Now, in his defense, really quickly, he says that at the end of the day, other tax cuts in this, you know, eliminating the alternative minimum tax, raising the standard deduction, means that a lot of Californians are going to be not going to be paying more taxes than they would otherwise. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you're going to find that this is not a good thing for the state of California.
Okay, so you mentioned those Orange County Republicans, one of whom is Daryl Issa, who is, he's in trouble. His reelection is in trouble.
Yep.
He's not supporting this bill, interestingly.
He is, last I checked, he is the only one who has said specifically that he will not support the bill. Some other ones have just not said, but he has specifically said he will not. And it's interesting because some people consider him the most vulnerable Republican. And as it was, you know, as it was, I think that these guys were endangered because the state's becoming more Democratic, especially where they live, and because of the health care thing. I know the House never got it through, but that's still an ad you can run against someone. You know, this guy, you know, this congressperson voted to take away your health benefits. You know what I mean? So they're already vulnerable on this count. So I think he made a political decision, which doesn't mean it's a bad decision, that he needed to do this to make sure that he had any chance to get reelected. You know, McCarthy's putting his members in a pretty tough position. I don't know whether he's telling them, you know, to get them to do this, but, you know, it's hard not – I mean, you can just see – I mean, I've been covering campaigns for a long time. These bills just lend themselves to the most easy and defensible attack ads that you can imagine, right? Like, your congressman voted to cut taxes for 1% of, you know, 1% of Californians and, you know, and corporate rich corporations. And at the same time, the average cost for a California homeowner has gone up, you know, I'm just throwing out numbers, $5,000. I mean, that's an easy ad to run, and it's a devastating ad to run. So I'm sure they're thinking about that.
But at the same time, then they've got their funders saying, if you don't vote for this, then we're not going to fund you.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing, right? You have people saying specifically that. Like, I've seen somebody say that a funder talked to him and said, if this doesn't go through, don't ever call me again. So they're in a really bad place, you know? I mean, I guess you could argue that they should do what they think is best for their constituents, but maybe that's a naive kind of point of view on the way democracy should work. But
Adam Nagorny, LA Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Thank you.
Sure. Anytime.
All right. Yesterday, the Justice Department said prosecutors are looking into appointing a special counsel to investigate something known as the Uranium One deal. Attorney General Jeff Sessions then equivocated about that in congressional hearing yesterday. But the deal was a big talking point among Trump supporters during the campaign. It's now back in the news. The whole thing revolves around the 2010 sale of a Canadian company called Uranium One to a Russian entity. Trump and other conservatives claim it was actually a shady play-to-pay scheme involving then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Depending on whether you watch Fox or MSNBC or something else, it's either a massive scandal or much ado about nothing.
Another massive Democratic scandal that is raising serious legal questions about the Obama administration and the Clintons.
There is no evidence, zero, of which we are aware that Hillary Clinton played any role in the State Department's deliberations over the deal.
So you think it was a good idea?
Okay, it's convoluted, it's confusing, and to demystify it now, I'm joined by Toby Harshaw. He writes editorials about national security for Bloomberg View. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Okay, Uranium One. This is a Canadian company?
It was a Canadian company. It is now Russian-owned, and that is where all the problems come in.
Right, exactly. And to add more confusion, they are talking about American uranium. So there's Canadian, formerly Canadian company wanting to sell to a Russian company who wants to buy American uranium.
That is exactly right. And because uranium is what it is, there are strong controls on exporting it out of the country. And therefore, a lot of this deal needed approval from the United States government at a point that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And that's where the scandal, or the quote-unquote scandal, comes in.
Well, there's that. And then there's also the Clinton Foundation. So what does that have to do with it?
Sure. Let's back up a little bit. This company, Uranium One, in 2007 or so, purchased a different Canadian mining company. That company had been owned by a guy named Frank Giustra, who is a pal of Bill Clinton's. He and his associates had given at least $35 million to various Clinton philanthropies. One of them was even a joint venture with Bill's and Giustra's name in it, and they had pledged about $100 million more at this point. Then Uranium One, a larger Canadian mining company, took over Giustra's company in 2007. In 2009, Uranium One was approached by Rosatom, which is Russia's state-owned nuclear energy monopoly, about possibly buying them, or buying 51% of them. At that point, because the mines that they had bought from Giustra were in the U.S., they needed to get American approval.
Oh my gosh, it is really confusing. But the implication here is that we're talking about something really scary, and that is nuclear weapons, right? That uranium, enriched uranium, is used to make nuclear weapons, and that once you've got Russians involved, then are they taking American uranium to build weapons that could be pointed at us, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think that's certainly what people on one side of this argument are implying. In fact, this isn't about nuclear weapons at all. This is about nuclear energy, which is an important thing. And that's what this uranium was going to be mined for and what it's going to be used for. The uranium that's mined in the United States is generally turned into something called yellow cake, which is a powder that's easy to transport. It is very low enriched uranium. It can be sent to other places and enriched to be appropriate for nuclear power. There's no question of any of it being used for nuclear weapons.
Because it can't be taken out of the country? Is that one reason?
In part because it can't be taken out of the country, in part because the places that it would go wouldn't be interested in building nuclear weapons out of it. Listen, the United States is a very minor player in the global uranium market. If a country was going to be building a nuclear arsenal, there are many, many easier places to go for your uranium. In fact, the real reason that Rosatom bought Uranium One, I believe, was that it had huge holdings in Kazakhstan, which is one of the world's largest producers of uranium. And I think that's what they coveted. In fact, to some extent, I wouldn't be surprised if having to buy the U.S. properties was a headache for them because they knew they would need permission for it.
Okay. And so, as you said, it needed to have approval, this sale, by something called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which is in...
CFIUS.
Yeah, known by that delightful acronym. And this is an amalgam of a bunch of different U.S. agencies who need to sign off on whether or not this is a national security threat. And they all unanimously said it was not. It was okay to go forward. One of those agencies is the State Department, and Hillary Clinton was running the State Department at the time. Did she personally sign off on this?
She says no, and various other high-level officials from her tenure say no. She was not involved in it personally.
Okay, so not only was there no money going to the Clinton Foundation at the time of this sale, she probably had nothing to do with it and may not have even known about it.
I wouldn't say there was no money going to the foundation at the time of the sale. There had been this $100 million in pledges. Nobody's really sure whether any of that turned up or not. Yeah, they had received gifts in the past from people involved with Uranium One. There wasn't anything immediately happening at that time. And as she said, you know, I don't know what's on a Secretary of State's daily calendars. It doesn't seem shocking to me that a deal, a relatively minor deal in terms of dollar terms, you know, proceeded through at lower levels.
Okay, so this was kind of ho-hum until the New York Times wrote about it in 2015 after Hillary Clinton announced her candidacy.
Well, this was a fairly remarkable thing. A gentleman named Peter Schweizer, who is been part of sort of the right-wing media and has written several sort of muckraking books. He's not an illegitimate guy by any means. He just very much comes from one standpoint. He's a solid investigator, though. He wrote this book called Clinton Cash. Dash, which had lots and lots of details about things that had gone on in the Clintons' philanthropic efforts. The New York Times got a hold of an advanced copy of it and decided that there was a lot to it. And very unusually, they worked with Schweizer before the book came out to write a few stories for the Times, sort of with their added investigatory powers, laying out various things that look pretty shady on the part of the foundation.
So what was the effect of that being on the front page of the New York Times?
Not a whole lot, actually. Other than, the Trump campaign, especially once it became clear that Trump was actually a serious candidate and then the candidate, harped on it a whole lot. I mean, let's face it, the Clintons, going back to cattle futures trading and Whitewater, the Clintons have been involved in so many shady things. This just sort of seemed like, one in a series and one that didn't have a whole lot to it, as far as I think, the mainstream media was concerned.
Okay, so very quickly, why is it coming up again now?
It's coming up now mostly because there was a report in The Hill, the Congressional Hill newspaper, that reported that there had been an FBI investigation into this sometime after the sale, but that it had been ignored by the Obama administration. And they quoted various anonymous officials about an anonymous informant who had given them details on a kickback scheme involving a trucking firm that trucked some of this uranium. It's very convoluted, but the idea was that the Obama administration quashed an FBI investigation into some aspect on the outside of the Uranium One deal in order to not have a larger investigation into it.
And any credibility to that?
There was an FBI investigation at the time that went nowhere. We know that. We know that there is this unnamed informant. He has been identified as an American businessman in a couple of places. We don't even know whether that's true. We have no idea whether he is a person who can be taken seriously or not. We don't really have any idea how broad the conspiracy that he's outlining goes. It may go no further than just a trucking company. But the Hill account was very, very loosely sourced. I work at Bloomberg. I used to work at the New York Times. I couldn't see either of those publications running with a story on the basis of sort of anonymous quotes of anonymous quotes. But it was enough to stir up the hornet's nest once again.
And here we are. Toby Harshaw writes editorials about national security for Bloomberg View. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how poisoned ice cream came into play in the coup against Africa's oldest dictator. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A military coup in Zimbabwe has placed its longtime president, Robert Mugabe, under house arrest. The 93-year-old Mugabe has dominated Zimbabwe politics for nearly 40 years. In his early years, he was hailed as a leader of the African Liberation Movement, a revolutionary overthrowing colonialism and white minority rule. But he has come to be seen as a brutal dictator running a corrupt government that suppresses all political opposition. Journalist and author Peter Godwin grew up in Zimbabwe. He recounts his experiences in his book, When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, a memoir of Africa. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about the news first. Mugabe apparently under house arrest. He is apparently safe. And the army seems to say this is not really a coup, but it is a coup, right? I mean, Mugabe is now no longer the president?
Yeah, I mean, it quacks like a coup and it walks like a coup. And I think it probably is a coup when a man in military uniform goes on state television at 4 a.m. to read a prepared statement. I think you're pretty firmly in coup territory at that point.
Right.
But it is true that it's not a kind of archetypal West African coup where normally the man who's reading the statement or his boss wants to be the new president. In this case, I think it's very unlikely that the military will try and keep power to themselves. They are doing this on behalf of one of Robert Mugabe's erstwhile trusted colleagues, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who had been kind of pushed out by Mugabe's ambitious wife.
Well, there has been a lot of dissatisfaction for many years over Mugabe and his rule. Why was it this moment that this happened?
Well, this isn't really directed at ZANU-PF, the ruling party. I mean, it's a faction fight. It's a kind of family squabble within the ruling party. And so it's not really about economic dissatisfaction. The sort of populace in Zimbabwe have been so beaten down now and cowed over, you know, multiple decades. And so many of them have left the country. This isn't a kind of popular uprising. It's a palace coup. So it really is a fight over the succession to Robert Mugabe.
Okay. And so the fact is that his vice president had been pushed aside by his wife. That was what was the animating factor.
Exactly, exactly. So in that sense, you know, although Zimbabweans are kind of, in general, all the ones I've spoken to, and there's a sense of kind of hope might be too much. I mean, they're excited by change. When you live in a country that's had the same leader for nearly 40 years, the sort of heavy hand of stasis is just so deadening to everybody that any kind of change is exciting.
So Zimbabwe has been a country since 1980, right? Independent.
It's been an independent country since 1980. Yeah.
And Mugabe has basically ruled that country since then, pretty much.
Absolutely. He has completely ruled it since then, yes.
So he was seen as a model leader back in the beginning,
well,
right? A hero?
Yes, he was. That's the general shtick that you hear. And it's the sort of shorthand that here was this guy, liberation leader, high hopes, came in, everything was great for a bit. He wasn't a communist. He didn't nationalize everything. You know, he left the farms alone, et cetera, et cetera. And then after his wife, Sally, who was a Ghanaian, died and he married Grace, he sort of had it sort of had a sudden rush of blood to the head, did all sorts of destructive things economically. The economy collapsed. You know, things went from bad to worse, failed state, yada, yada. But I don't really subscribe to that. I mean, if you look at it a little closer, what you see here is a man who has always used violence to get his political ends. And so if you go all the way back to the very early 80s, I reported on the Matabeleland massacres where Mugabe sent his North Korean-trained 5th Brigade down into the south of the country to quell dissent and killed, we don't know exactly how many, but in the region of 20,000 civilians. Hmm. And, you know, that was in 1983-84. That was just 3 or 4 years into his rule. And then he forced the opposition parties into a one-party state. So there was then no opposition. So I think, you know, he has always responded to political challenges with violence. And in that sense, there's something rather apposite and kind of fitting that it's the army that unseats him.
So we don't know who's going to run Zimbabwe.
We sort of do. I mean, we think it's going to be Emmerson Mnangagwa, who was the vice president until a week or so ago, and when he was unceremoniously booted by Mugabe, obviously at Grace Mugabe's behest, and he had to flee the country in fear of his life. And shortly before that, he claimed to have his ice cream had been poisoned at a rally, and he had to be casavacked to South Africa to sort of have his stomach pumped and one thing another. So he fled.
Wait, hang on. Poisoned by whom?
Well, I mean, who do you say? You know, he clearly had his own ideas by someone from the Grace Mugabe camp.
And hasn't Mugabe himself accused his opponents of practicing witchcraft?
Yes, they throw witchcraft accusations left, right and center. It's extraordinary. I mean, he's done that against other people who've fallen out of favor with him, like Joyce Majuru, who was the previous vice president. And there's a pattern here that as soon as somebody, anybody, looked like they were grooming themselves or making a play to be his successor, he would chop them off at the knees. Joyce Majuru was kicked out that way. And then the same thing happened to Mnangagwa. And it was becoming obvious by then that Grace Mugabe, I beg your pardon, was really making a play for the top job herself. And that changed everything when that happened.
Wow, it's positively Roman in its intrigue. poisoning.
Absolutely.
The machinations of the wife. I mean, it's like I, Claudius all over again.
No. I mean, it's fantastically dramatic. And the plot swings and the changing alliances, and it's very, very hard to keep up. And what you saw, ironically, was Mugabe, you know, very old and enfeebled at 93, trying to hand power over to his wife, who was only in her early 50s, instead of to Emmerson Mnangagwa, who, you know, at 75, you'd think is fairly elderly, but is positively sprightly when compared to Mugabe himself.
Okay, so what happens to Mugabe now? Does he just live out his days in exile?
Well, that's the big question. So right now, as far as the last I heard, he is confined to his rather opulent 26-bedroom residence with a jade roof given by the Chinese while they try and negotiate what his exit passage will be. I suspect that they won't put up with him staying in the country because he presents too much of a threat. They have houses. They have houses in Johannesburg and Singapore, I think, and Hong Kong and various other places, that's what's being negotiated at the moment. There were reports originally that Grace had already fled to Namibia. Then those reports were denied. She has a slight problem in going to South Africa because she assaulted a young girl she found in her son's hotel room. She assaulted her with an electricity extension cable and hit,
wow,
and hurt her so badly she had to have stitches all over her forehead. So the police were after her, and Grace Mugabe had to be hustled out of the country under bogus diplomatic immunity. So she may have a problem going back to South Africa, and that the cops will be after her.
Oh my gosh. The intrigue continues. Well, thanks so much for updating us.
You're welcome.
That's journalist and author Peter Godwin. He's author of the book When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, A Memoir of Africa. Coming up, Daniel Tammet, a savant with numbers and words. He once recited pi from memory to more than 20,000 decimal places.
When I looked at digits of pi growing up as a child, I could see in it a story, even an epic, like something out of Homer, the Iliad, or the Odyssey.
Daniel Tammet's love of numbers and words, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Daniel Tammet identifies himself as a high-functioning autistic savant. He has a remarkable memory and a special gift for numbers. When he was 25 years old, he held a reading at Oxford University on Pi Day, March 14th. Over 5 hours, he recited the number pi to more than 20,000 decimal places from memory. But while numbers were easy for him, even as a child, language was not, particularly when it meant using it to communicate with other people. But he has overcome those issues, and then some. He currently speaks 11 languages fluently, including Icelandic, which he learned in just 1 week for a television documentary. And he's become an author. His latest book is about language. It's called Every Word is a Bird We Teach to Sing, Encounters with the Mysteries and Meanings of Language. And Daniel Tammet joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, as a child, numbers were the first indication of your abilities, and you can do these complex calculations in your head. I just mentioned that remarkable feat at Oxford University reciting pi. But it's more than that, right? Numbers aren't just figures on a page to you. They're actually beautiful images. Can you describe what numbers look like to you?
Well, that's absolutely right. I grew up with a strange feeling. I was born in Britain, raised in London. Both my parents spoke English, only English at home. And yet for many years I felt foreign. I didn't feel like English was my first language. And it was numbers. That felt like my first language. In my head, numbers have shapes and colours and textures. This is a neurological phenomenon that scientists call synesthesia, a mixing of the senses. And what it meant is that numbers to me were like calligraphy, something very beautiful and something meaningful. So, for example, when I first saw snow falling one winter, I looked and, of course, I knew the English word for snow. And that's what I said to my parents. But in my head, in the language of numbers that I used in my mind, I would say to myself, 89, because 89 is the shape of snow falling. And another example would be the number 4. I was always very much like the number 4 growing up. The number 4 is blue and pointy in my mind, but it also has a meaning that is very close to the English meaning of shyness, and I was very shy, like the number 4, all the time that I was growing up. But the number that I guess best resumes my childhood is the number 757. And this particular number, the best I could do to describe it would be to compare it to a ginger root. It's a round and rather knobbly number, and it has a very specific meaning that doesn't have any equivalent that I've found in English or any other language. It means both the feeling of great loneliness and at the same time a commensurate desire to reach out and to connect to other people. And this was the feeling that I had very much all through my childhood, all through those years growing up, feeling very alone and at the same time wanting to reach out to other people and wanting to learn how to communicate.
How were you able to overcome that and connect to other people if you are communicating or you're thinking in this entirely different language as a child?
You're right. I mean, it was difficult. I was thinking and feeling and sometimes even dreaming in this synesthetic language, this numerical language of pictures and colors and textures. And at the same time, I could feel loneliness and want to relate to other people, the children at school, for example. One of the things that helped me enormously and obviously contributed to my vocation as a writer was literature, the discovery of books. I was born and raised in a working class family in London. My parents didn't have a lot of education. They had a lot of love, and they would take me every so often to the library, the municipal library, and it's free, of course. Anyone can go in and read, and I started off reading factual books, encyclopedias and dictionaries, but as I got a little bit older and my emotions improved and my social skills started to improve, I would go to literature, I would go to short stories and novels, and I devoured so many books from that time on and learned so much about empathy. Every time I read a novel, I would be trying to get inside the characters' minds. It was transparent, of course, to what the thoughts and the feelings were on the page, and then I would take that dialogue out with me into the playground. And of course, what I was learning all the time on the fly was that language is something that's social and something you can't only learn from books.
Right. And then you teach language. You as a young man, you decide to go to Lithuania to teach, and you don't know the language at all. And
no.
You're asked to teach these women English. And so that must have been interesting, a young man trying to teach these Lithuanian women English and not knowing one word of it. And how did you decide? You decided to teach it in a totally different way than the normal way by going through a textbook. And
yeah, I went to Lithuania when I was 19. It was a volunteer scheme that took kids from difficult backgrounds or disability and so on, and gave them a chance to go out into the world. And so I seized this opportunity. I wanted very much to travel and to see the world. In Lithuania, I discovered a people that were fantastically open and generous, and they'd recently chased away the tanks of the Soviet Union. So they were a very proud people as well. They'd spent many years under the Soviet occupation. They'd not been allowed to use their language. They'd had to use Russian. So very early on, I realized the power of words. And when it came to teaching language, it was about dealing with that power. If I didn't want to impose English on anyone, as Russian had been imposed on these women, But at the same time, it was an exchange. I gave them English because they wanted to learn it, and in exchange, I learned their Lithuanian. I didn't go through a textbook because textbooks were dry and boring, as I'm sure you found at school learning mm-hmm. Spanish, for example. Many Americans have told me that experience. What I did do was use my own experience of acquiring language, words as pictures, words as having shapes and forms, and you can play with those shapes and forms, the pictures that particular combinations of letters make, and form what I would call word webs, whereby you take a word like apple, for example, that's one of the examples I use in the book, and say to yourself, what words are like this shape, the shape of the word apple, the letters in apple, the A at the beginning, the E at the end, the P's in between. And the students loved this game. They took their dictionaries, they scoured the pages, they came up with their own suggestions, words like appetite, for example, or plate, or pill, or pips, all playing with the letters in the word apple, and of course having something to do with the meaning behind the letters as well. And this makes it so much more fun.
And you talk a lot in the book, or several essays in your book, talk about this kind of language nationalism. Of course, France, where you live right now, there's been a very strong push to preserve the purity of the French language. And also in Iceland, I was interested to learn that you can't name your kid any name you want. You have to choose from a list that the government provides.
Yeah, there's an academy that deals with infant naming, because names in Icelandic are words. And because Icelandic words have gender, like French and many other languages of Europe. So they take very great care to make sure that boys are called names that are masculine, words that are masculine, and girls, words that are feminine in terms of gender. And there is a lot of debate in the country. There are very liberal people. One of the first countries in the world to give women the vote, for example, 100 years ago. So it's quite paradoxical that at the same time this country, which is so liberal and so open-minded, should be so conservative when it comes to language. And I guess part of it comes down to the fear, of course, that they are going to lose their language. English is such a wonderful tool of communication internationally, but there is also that risk that it will dominate other languages and eventually lead to their extinction. And Icelandic is a very small language, only 300,000 people in the whole country. And so they are very wary. And I guess the committee is part of the expression of that wariness.
Mm. Well, that's understandable. I can see how they'd want to preserve their identity because, as you say, identity is your own identity is wrapped up in your language. I'm wondering how you see yourself because you do speak so many languages. And how do you see yourself as expressed through language?
It's a really good question. Language to me is, for a long time was something that was a struggle, a painful struggle, to learn to communicate with other people, to learn how to reach out and to use words and use words in the right way to express myself and to make myself understood. But because it was a struggle, it became a passion as well, and it became a vocation as a writer. And I learned as I read the literature of many countries, sometimes quite often in the original language itself, that there were many writers in history that were also what we call polyglots, people who used different languages, many languages, some of them. Tolstoy is a famous example. And even someone like Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, who was also synesthetic like myself, saw words with different colours, and wrote originally in Russian and then switched to English to write Lolita and other novels. Of course, he spent many years in America.
Can you describe the affinity that you have for poetry and how it relates to your first language, numbers? Lots of poetry is mathematically based, of course. And so is that one reason why you looked to poetry to help
Absolutely.
With the language and figure out different languages?
You mentioned Pi earlier and the fact that I'd recited Pi to over 22,500 places from memory some years ago. And for some people, it would just have been a gimmick in a way, or a sort of trick. In fact, it was much deeper than that. It was a very meaningful experience to me because it was poetry, pure poetry. Pi, to me, because of the way that I'm able to look at numbers and see them in shapes and textures and colours that are meaningful to me and have meaning, like calligraphy, when I looked at digits of pi growing up as a child, I could see in it a story, even an epic, like something out of Homer, the Iliad or the Odyssey, for example. And for me, it was something much more than numbers. It was poetry. And the people who were listening, because there was a public that had come along especially to listen to this young man reciting and inhabiting this number, giving it a body and breath and so much emotion. And the emotion was there because it was expressing everything that I'd lived up until that point, up until my 25 years, all my 25 years up until then, living on the autistic spectrum, the loneliness and the frustration and the determination also to overcome that handicap and to learn to communicate and to relate to people. And here I was at that time speaking fluently in numbers, not in English or French or any other language, in the language of numbers, because it was, to me, my mother tongue.
Hmm. Well, it doesn't sound to me that you have a handicap at all. In fact, quite the opposite.
Thank you.
Do you see yourself as handicapped in any way?
No, I express myself very well in several languages. But what is most important to me is just using my abilities to make the words. For me, the words shine and shimmer on the page. This is part of how I perceive language. It's something that is just intrinsically beautiful. And this is what I want to get across to my readers, to give them, for the time that it takes them to get from one page, one end of the book to the other, to give them an experience of synesthesia, to experience language in some way as I do, as something that is just incredibly beautiful, incredibly moving, and incredibly liberating as well, with incredible powers, the power to liberate a young boy born in poverty and autism.
Daniel Tammet, he's the author of Every Word is a Bird We Teach to Sing, Encounters with the Mysteries and Meanings of Language. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the independent movie house Cine Family shuts down for good. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're a serious movie buff here in L.A., you've probably been to Cine Family at the historic Silent Movie Theater on Fairfax. Cine Family was founded 10 years ago. It became one of the most interesting and eclectic places to see movies anywhere. Shows had special guests, live music, dance parties. They cut their own movie trailers there, like this one for the film Get Rollin', about roller disco in Brooklyn's black community.
It was like I caught a skating fever or something. You know, I didn't even come home that night. I sat there amazed by all the skaters and all the music and all the power and all the energy in the ring. And the next morning, I went and bought me some skates, and I've been skating ever since.
And Cine Family was also a place to socialize.
I used to go through the audience with a 30-pack of beer, and I would kind of like get to know everybody, and then I would ask for their emails, and I would make sure that I asked personally every single person who came through the door for their email list. I think we're a lot more aggressive about reaching people maybe than a lot of theaters, but there's nothing quite beats the personal touch. I guess you gotta have a little promoter in your blood, a little P.T. Barnum.
That was co-founder Hadrian Belove 2 years ago in an interview with the media platform The Hundreds. He is one of the reasons Cine Family is shutting down. That's a recent decision by the 16-member board. In August, anonymous emails accused him of sexual harassment and assault, and Cine Family's board vice president was accused of rape. Both of them resigned in August. Well, we want to look back at what made Cine Family Cine Family and whether it can be replaced. Matt Holzman is host of KCRW's podcast, The Document. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. So what was it about Sinner Family? I mean, there was a little essence there that in the intro with the parties and the interesting films. But for you, what is it? Why was it special?
Well, you know, when there are film repertory theaters, they usually fall into two categories. One's very academic, one's esoteric, and the other is like, we want to have the biggest names possible and impress everybody. And this was a place for people who loved movies, period. It was the most unpretentious place. It was just a place where we're going to put it on the screen because we love this thing. And Hadrian Belov called the place pathologically idiosyncratic, and he likened it to a mixtape. You know, it's kind of funky, it's unpredictable, but it's made with a lot of passion. It's filled with surprises, and that was true. I mean, I was just looking at the last schedule that they have up on their website, and they do everything here from the French 60s films called the Zanzibar films, which frankly I have no idea
Never
what that
heard
is. Of. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
They had a series called The History of the Midnight Movie with every kind of fun, incredible, wacky, nutty film possible. They were screening The Harder They Come, that classic 72 kind of reggae film with Jimmy Cliff. I mean, it was so esoteric. And then there would be these trailers that were mixed with just pure joy. There was a joy of cinema. And what is interesting is that the kind of these terrible stories that we're hearing, they so don't jive with the experience that you would have when you went there, which was so collegial and so fun. It had a garden in the back that you could hang out and have a beer and talk about movies with people. And it was the kind of place where you could go on any night that they were showing something, not know what was happening, and just experience the sheer joy of experiencing film.
Yeah. And sometimes the filmmakers would show up and you could meet them
back
in the
garden. There was filmmakers, there was live kind of scoring. There was just, it was so unpredictable and it was so full of life.
I know. So is that all because of Hadrian Belov? Was it his vision?
Yes, I think no and yes. I think it was very much his vision. I think the people that he surrounded himself with were incredibly savvy about film and passionate about film, and you saw that every day. There were a lot of people, including a pretty large cast of volunteers who made the place what it is. But there was something about his vision for what it was going to be that was very, very important. And, you know, if you ever met him, he was kind of a guy who was a little rough around the edges too, but loved movies. And,
yeah.
and it was a reflection of him in a lot of ways.
Right. So now, I mean, we heard that clip in the introduction and it kind of like, given all the accusations.
Yeah.
I mean, is this even a place where you would want it to... I mean, want it to survive or should it be shut down?
I don't know. I don't really have an opinion on that. I will say that the dichotomy between these stories and my personal experience is so wide. I can imagine, though, that people who experience the bad side of Sinner Family are feeling very torn because they know there's no place like it, I think probably in the world, for people who love movies. And that this Mecca, this place that they could go, that they could call home, is gone. Even if they had terrible experiences there, I imagine that it must be they must be very torn.
So some people are wondering, well, why not? If it was, sure, it was Hadrian's vision, but there were other people, as you say, who implemented and had their own vision. Why not reopen it with someone who could do something similar?
I don't know. I don't know that somebody could do something similar. I think it was never very financially stable. I think a lot of the people, you know, it was funded partially by people in Hollywood. I think it's become a little radioactive. So I can't really answer that question. And it is very sad. I know there are some people who are going to be thrilled that it's going to disappear. It's kind of like, you know, where there's a place where some tragedy occurs and you want to just kind of raise it to the ground and pretend like it never happened. But I can say this, it is a really, really sad day for people who love film. And I am really sorry for people who never went because it was very special. It's interesting that in a city, you know, we're it's Hollywood, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not known for like great films. We're known for big films. And in this one little place, I don't think there was another place, maybe in the world, that was celebrating film in the way they were, with pure love and passion.
But there are other art houses and indie movie theaters.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
So,
you know, where can people go?
Oh, American Cinematheque, obviously, in Santa Monica and in Hollywood are always showing amazing, amazing movies. And the theaters, too. The Cinematheque, the Egyptian, is a beautiful place. So that's obviously one. UCLA has Melnitz movies that the film school puts on, and they're open to the public. They're very inexpensive, and they tend to be, you know, wonderful. Plus, you get to be on campus. And, you know, one of the things we miss often in L.A. is walking out of the theater and putting your trench coat on and lighting the cigarette. And you know what I mean? And there's a chance to do that because you're on the UCLA campus.
I don't know if you can light a cigarette on the campus.
You can vape. I don't know if you can do that. There's Film Independent at LACMA, curated by our own Elvis Mitchell, mm-hmm. who, that shows incredible films. And they do other events, too. Like, they do live readings of scripts, et cetera. So there's the great events there. For documentaries, the IDA does a lot of free screenings at the Landmark and on the West Side. And obviously, KCRW has its own The Document screening series. There's the New Beverly theater that is a repertory theater. There's LA Film Forum that does kind of avant-garde films. And I will say there are 106 LA film festivals, so there's always something going on with film in this town.
Okay, so it's not all lost.
No, I guess not.
All right. Thank you, Matt Holzman. Matt Holzman is host of KCRW's podcast, The Document. Go download that. It's fantastic. Thanks, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.